You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, sponsored by Indeed. If you're hiring for your organisation, Indeed is all you need, because Indeed sponsored jobs will help you stand out from the crowd and hire the best possible candidates who can give you the results that you need. Spend more time interviewing candidates who tick all of your boxes. There's less stress, less time spent casting your net far and wide, and better results now with Indeed sponsored jobs. And because you listen to the show, you'll get a £100 sponsored job credit to help get your job the premium status it deserves at indeed.com/cycle. So just go to indeed.com/cycle right now and say you support the Cycling Podcast by saying you heard about Indeed on the show. That's indeed.com/cycle. Now, why does Indeed set you apart from all of the other companies out there? Well, according to Indeed's data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed are 90% more likely to report a quality hire than non-sponsored jobs. That's because you're reaching a much wider pool of candidates. So join the 1.6 million companies that sponsor their jobs with Indeed. Go to indeed.com/cycle. Terms and conditions apply. If you're hiring, do it the right way with Indeed. Now it's on with the show.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and welcoming you on this Tuesday, March the 10th, after a weekend when the battle for interstellar domination between the Slovenian Tadej Pogacar and Air France Paul Sexas lit up the Tuscan skies. That is Air France with an H, of course. My name is Daniel Freeman. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, in which we will do our best to talk around all those of you who saw Saturday as merely the resumption of the snooze fest to which Pog has subjugated professional cycling for several years now. By we, I mean a man who always brings the pyrotechnics, although I think he took a hangover back home from Siena at the weekend. It is Il Barone, the Baron, Brian Nygaard.
Hey, Daniel. Hey, Lionel. Brian. Good to be back.
And speaking of UFOs and extraterrestrials, it is the Rocket Man of Not Watford, Lionel Burney.
Hello, Daniel. Hello, Brian. Nice to see you again.
Thank you very much. Likewise.
Brian, looking chipper 48 hours later. There was some wine drunk after the race on Saturday, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, just a little. It is a few bottles were had. Yes, met some good friends, and it is Chianti, isn't it? We have to adhere to the local traditions. And
when in Chianti,
exactly. And yeah. What happens in Siena stays in Siena.
There you go. Well, you were on the ground. We were there in force. Although you were working for other people, both you and Michele Pellacci were both in Siena on Saturday, soaking up the atmosphere and other things. We will hear about your experiences in Siena later on in the episode. But chaps, before we talk about events at the weekend, there's been some interesting news emanating from Denmark, not actually from Denmark. And in fact, we don't even know if it regards Denmark, but it's been sort of attributed to Denmark. Over the last 24 hours, and that is, or they are, reports that Ineos Grenadiers may have a new sponsor arriving at some point soon, and it may be a Danish software company. A couple of authoritative sources and outlets reported this yesterday, that maybe a Danish IT company or software company may be sponsoring Ineos Grenadiers to the tune of around about 20 million euros a year for the next 5 years. Chaps, yesterday I heard some rumors early in the day that it was actually going to be a Norwegian energy company, Equinor. I wasn't the only person to hear this. I know our good friend Raymond Kirkhoffs from the Netherlands also heard this. He reported it, but then we were disabused of this notion, because Equinor, spokespeople for Equinor, first spoke to our Norwegian colleagues at TV2 and told them that it was fake news. And then they also spoke to other people and repeated that it will not be them who are sponsoring Ineos Grenadiers in the future. Brian, what did you make of this?
I was certainly surprised to hear that that type of investment, and also the size of that type of investment, could come out of Denmark. And I really, you could nail it down to almost just one company, the biggest software Danish company, biggest Danish software company. They not. I mean, they're the size that could pull it off, but I would be surprised if they would do it now. But
what are they called, Brian?
They're called Net Company. They right. The biggest sort of subsidiary is called Nets, and they run all the payment services in Denmark. They run the personal ID that you use for to do all the transactions you have in Denmark when you log on to your health services, your public services, etc. And they've just recently done a very large international service deal for bigger foreign companies as well. So they're basically the only company that can do it. So, I mean, it's just a question of whether it's them or it's false news or fake news, as you would say. It made me think, you know, that there were also news that they would replace either Ineos or Grenadiers in the naming rights of the team. And it goes to say that at 20 million euros a year doesn't even give you the first, might not even give you the first name of said team, of Ineos, which is, you know, I remember back when Leopard Trek was probably one of the three wealthiest teams in the world. Some, what's that now, 15 years ago, our budgets were just short of 17 million euros. And we had some of the biggest riders in the world. A lot has happened, and it's not just inflation.
Yeah, yeah.
And it, you know, normal inflation, but in the inflation of salaries of bike riders.
Yeah, the report suggested that Ineos would remain owners of the team. Not sure whether I'm sure their name would probably appear somewhere on the jersey. Total Energy, of course, are on the hook for a while. We think they're putting in about 15 million euros a year, but that might go up, especially at the end of this year when they pull out of sponsorship of the French team that bears their name currently. And one thing, chaps, that struck me as curious was that, well, we know that Visma, Lisa Bike, Visma, also software company, but Norwegian, we know Richard Plugger's looking for a sponsor, and they have the biggest Danish rider of the moment, Jonas Vingegaard. So they would seem like good candidates for a Danish software company at the moment.
Yeah, another thing that's also not ironic, it's quite sad actually, you know, the Danish National Cycling Federation is pretty close to being bankrupt. You know, they've had a very poor economy for the last several years, and they're losing now their title sponsor for, and it's been it for decades. It means that the Tour of Denmark, the national team, they basically closed the national team for mountain bike, the Danish federation, and the private sponsor had to pick that up, and they are out of sponsorship at the end of this year. So it's quite interesting to see what actually will happen and what type of money will come out of Denmark and where it'll end up. But I was also surprised, you know, when you saw, you know, another Danish company called Faxacondi, which is an energy drink of sorts, entered into UnoX just the other week. And I heard from quite reliable sources that the size of that engagement was around 8 million euros a year. That's pretty lofty.
That would be huge, just for the sleeve that is. The sort of the going rate for the sleeve of sort of Premier League football teams up until a couple of years ago was about 10 million pounds a year.
Yeah.
So not that far short.
Apparently, but this included apparently also activation, which, you know, would also be quite costly if you really wanted to get that type of visibility. But it was a source very close to the decision making, so it wouldn't be that far off, I think. So it is quite interesting how much more expensive it has become. And you would think when that type of investment goes in, it's because you want more firing power on the athlete side, you know, because the structure is already there. It's certainly within yours in this case.
Briefly, Lionel, does this smell credible, likely?
Well, we know that Ineos Grenadiers, you know, ultimate owner of which is Jim Ratcliffe, they want to take the burden of paying for the cycling team away from Jim Ratcliffe's wallet, don't they? So they've been looking for other investors. I must admit, when I heard the sort of word cloud of Denmark software companies, and then I heard that Brian was joining us on the podcast, I thought CSC was coming back. We were going to have some kind of...
Well, that's actually an American. Yeah, that's an American company.
Yeah, I know it is. But, you know, we've got Rabobank on the Visma Lisa Bike jersey. We could, you know, we can have an early 2000s party and bring back all of the sponsors from the early 2000s. Discovery Channel will be back as well next before we
T-Mobile.
T-Mobile.
What about a... What about a Reese Remontada?
But yeah, I mean,
that's very funny you say about T-Mobile coming back. I had a dream last night, chaps, in which Rod Ellingworth was the manager of the T-Mobile women's team, and he was wearing magenta tracksuit bottoms.
Oh, that's to admit that in front of an audience, Daniel.
You've just reminded me of that. It's one of those rare dreams that was very vivid even after I woke up, and it remains vivid 4 or 5 hours later.
Now with our listeners.
On the other hand, oil and gas as a potential investor, I mean, that would fit with the kind of the rest of the corporate structure there, wouldn't it? Ineos, a massive chemical company, Total Energies. How would that all fit in together? Obviously, a pretty volatile industry at the moment, but prices are booming, aren't they? So, I mean, we'll have to see. But will this be something that they may well unveil, you know, in the lead up to the Tour de France? You would imagine that that's the kind of time frame that we'd be looking at. So maybe there'll be a revamp, and they'll be able to legitimately ditch these light grey shorts, Ineos Grenadiers.
I quite like the grey shorts. I put some feelings out yesterday to people at Ineos, but no one was really biting. So we will have to wait
But the other thing,
chaps,
is, you know, the team itself wants to regain its place at the very top of the sport. It's been left behind to a degree by UAE Team Emirates and before that Visma Lisa Bike, and even sort of you look at what's going on at Decathlon with Paul Seixas, who we're going to talk a lot about in the rest of the episode. But Seixas may well be available at the end of 2027 when his contract expires, and I would think that there will be a heck of a bidding war. And so getting some money in at this point now so that they could be one of the first to put down a big offer for Seixas.
There's certainly one Scandinavian country benefiting from all of this, and that's Finland.
In what regard?
Do you know why? A Seixas agent is
that's true.
Finnish.
Unilauke,
Of course.
Unilauke. He'll have a blast when that contract will be up for negotiation.
Anyway, chaps, more about the French enfant prodige Seixas in part two.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode of the Cycling Podcast is brought to you by BICMO Cycle Insurance, because let's face it, things happen. Whether it's a crash landing, the heartbreak of a stolen bike, or the ultimate facepalm moment of reversing over your prized aero wheel, BICMO has you covered. Flexible policies that you can cancel anytime, 50% off extra bikes in your household, protection for your kit, race entries, and even damage while travelling to your next epic ride. They've thought of it all. And here's the thing, BICMO isn't some faceless insurance company. They're all bike riders too, with a shared mission to protect the world's riders and the places we ride. So when you insure with them, you're not just getting great coverage, you're joining a community that gets what it means to love cycling. So whether you're smashing sprints, grinding climbs, or just enjoying a Sunday spin, ride safe. BICMO's got your back. Protect your ride before it's too late. Head to BICMO.com to get covered. That's BICMO.com. Flexible policies. Cancel anytime. Terms apply. Check your policy docs.
Well, as established in part one, Brian, you were in Siena at the weekend. We're going to hear about your adventures in just a moment. But traditionally, in most of our episodes, certainly in the classic season, we take a detour via Corvitz Corner. We'll certainly be continuing to visit Corvitz Corner throughout the Northern Classics, shall we say, the Belgian Classics and also Paris-Roubaix week. But I've given Hugo the week off this week. Why? Because we had a second correspondent in Siena. And that was Michele Pellacci, of course, of Giro d'Italia, 2025 Giro d'Italia fame. He'll be joining us again at Giro later in the year, as will you, Brian. But together, Brian, you and Pellacci, you created a sort of collage of impressions, observations from Siena. Hence, I propose, before we talk about Strade Bianche, we take a detour this week via Piazza Pellacci. Viva la nostra Siena,
viva la nostra Siena. Ciao Daniele, and ciao to Oldie.
Cycling Podcast listeners. This is Michele Pedacci from Siena. I'm just under Porta di Fontebranda. And listen, these are the Jay Corulla guys. Flying by. Oh my goodness, Filippo Conca, Italian national champion on Santa Caterina. He was in zone 2, I was zone 7. That was brutal, but it's so beautiful here. You got 5 frittelle for 1.5 euros. Super cheap. And they are frying frittelle all day here.
Buone, eh?
Sì.
Sono buone, eh?
Buone.
Sotto la crema?
No, solo riso.
Solo riso.
Solo riso.
Ho capito.
Sono dolci.
How crunchy they are. It's a taste, live taste.
All right.
Just can't top Siena, Daniele. You can't beat this. It's March 7th. Saturday morning in Siena. We're here for the start of the Strade Bianche men's elite and women's elite races in Fortezza Medicea. It's an old fortress in downtown Siena.
Girls in front of me follow the moto, and I also follow them. And then we are late when I saw the radio. This is not the way, not this good way.
I think you can feel a bit of like somberness here with everyone, with Visma there behind as well. I think when with UAE like that, there's not much you can do. I mean. Yeah,
trying to get someone in the breakaway, but it maybe took a little bit longer than other years, and then we never really got given very much time, and we ended up having to ride quite hard, and by the time the peloton caught us in the Santa Maria section, they came past double our speed, and then that was kind of it. It was quite impressive actually when they came past.
Of course, we're there. Motel Maestro, Larry Borbasse for the Cycling Podcast at the Strade Bianche. Larry, you're covered in dust.
Yeah, it was a hard day out there. And unfortunately, I was a bit behind a lot of times, which is why I'm more covered in dust than probably most people. Better to be in the front, I think. But yeah. It was a hard day out. Yeah.
Well, Brian, that all sounded very lovely, very atmospheric. We heard from various people there. Mavi Garcia after the women's race, very exciting women's race after that, that sort of incident when several of the women's riders went the wrong way. That reminded me, I've taken part in trail races, chaps, where we've gone off course. It's something that happens quite frequently in sort of amateur trail races, but it happened in Strade Bianche the weekend. And it's not the first time that a pro race has gone the wrong way, but there was something quite sort of quintessentially sort of Tuscan Strade Bianche about heading down an even whiter road towards a sort of abandoned farm buildings. Anyway, we heard from Mavi Garcia, we heard from Tom Pidcock speaking to TNT, we also heard from Jack Haig speaking to Pelacci, and the Motown maestro himself, Larry Warbas, after a difficult day for most of the field, and Larry as well admitted that it had been a difficult day in the saddle. But Brian, it sounded like a magical day, fantastic crowds, fantastic TV figures, actually, TV audience in Italy as well. How was it for you?
Well, every time I go to Siena, I remember the last time I was there was with you, Daniel, when Wout van Aert won the Giro stage. That race is really becoming even bigger than it was last year. I think in spite of the absolute dominance of Pogacar, it's a futile discussion to say that is it or is it not the sixth monument, because you know it takes more than 20 editions to compete with, you know, each of the other monuments had more than 100. But I was reading something yesterday, and I certainly disagree that you cannot say that a win in Strade Bianche is more prestigious than Il Lombardia, because Il Lombardia has the magnitude of a monument. but it's not very far off, in my opinion. And when you look at the prestige, when you look at the crowds, when you look at just how spectacular the setting is and how spectacular the finish is, and the uniqueness of the gravel roads, that in a lot of way gives that race something that no other race has. And I know that, you know, the Paris Tour has, and I know that the Trofeo Brolléon, they also have gravel roads, but there's just something, there's a singularity and a uniqueness of this race. And I think RCS have even probably better than some of the other brands, you could call it, they've been able to protect and develop this in a very unique way. And I think that Strade Bianche is becoming something that I think, in a way, that Paris-Roubaix has also become a fixture for people outside of the normal viewing sort of cycling, that they will watch Tour de France and Paris-Roubaix, and I think slowly they'll also be watching the Strade Bianche. For me, it's one of those races where it's not just the racing, but it's certainly also the atmosphere. You know, when you see the crowds at the Santa Catarina when the riders come in, and when you see how fascinated the crowds are, you know, it was a little bit dicey, I think, when you look at how, like, it was like four layers deep on the Pinsuto. I was a little bit worried about what could have happened. But I just think it's a tribute to how popular cycling is and how popular it is to go to a bike race, right? You know, that I think is the real clue of this.
One thing I would say there, Brian, I don't know whether you would agree, but one of the genius aspects of Strade Bianche is that it effectively it gate crashes a party that's already happening, that party is tourism in Siena. And we don't see that many other races that do that in a similar fashion. And of course, to the watching public, to someone watching on TV, they don't know any difference. They don't realize that those people haven't necessarily come for the bike race. But what you get, and some of the photography on after Saturday was just extraordinary. You get the Piazza del Campo full up, as it would be for the Palio, for the two editions of the Palio that take place every year. And it just looks as if everyone is there for the bike race.
Man, I think it's just how picturesque it also is, you know, the contrast between this iconic, and I really think you can use that word here, that is such an archetypal of a landscape, of real southern Tuscan landscape, you know, the rolling hills, the cypress trees, the Chianti vineyards, and then the beauty that is Siena, you know, this hilltop that they come into via the old gate coming in, and then the Santa Catarina. I just think how could that not be a monument, whether you want to call it the six or not, but it is certainly a monumental race. And you really get that feeling and the buzz the day before, and you know, and that RCS have also, you know, they've been able to, there's what now 7,000 people riding the race the day after. All the restaurants are packed, all the bars are packed. That there's certainly a feeling that I think that a lot of the other races, even if they would want it to get that type of atmosphere or vibe or tourism, even they couldn't. You know, you wouldn't be able to do that in San Remo. You wouldn't certainly not be able to do that in Liège for a lot of other obvious reasons. So I would recommend it to anyone if they were to go and see one race, because it's a package, isn't it? You know, you can go and eat lovely food and drink great wine, and there's a lot of other things to see in Siena.
But I also think that Tadej Pogacar winning 4 out of 5 editions has really kind of elevated the profile, the importance. It's sprinkled an awful lot of prestige on the race as well. The fact that he is so dominant. We can talk a little bit about that dominance and the fact that...
Oh, yeah.
I'll burst the balloon as well as anyone, Daniel. But when we look back in 20 years' time, we will look back at this era as almost sort of Eddie Merckx and Milan Sanremo, or, you know, Sean Kelly and Paris-Nice, you know, riders who have come to define the race almost. Strade Bianche has a very prestigious list of winners. I mean, basically, the very best classics riders have won it whilst at the peak of their powers. I mean, it's a very young race, isn't it? 2007, but, you know, Fabian Cancellara won it 3 times. His record's now been broken by Pogacar, of course, but Philippe Gilbert, you know, a real classics star. Julian Alaphilippe was at the peak of his powers when he won it. Wout van Aert, the same. Mathieu van der Poel, the same. You know, even Tom Pidcock, although he hasn't quite reached the same level in those classic races, you know, that was an impressive victory. But Pogacar has really made Strade Bianche his own. Four wins out of 5 years. Of course, he didn't start in 2023 when Pidcock won. But if you look at those four victories, he has really set the blueprint for how to win it, or certainly for how he wins it. And over those four editions, he spent 228 kilometres out in front on his own across the four races. And his winning margin across the four is 5 minutes and 45 seconds. So if you kind of made this four consecutive Giro d'Italia stages, you know, he's kind of won a grand tour in the space of these four one-day races, hasn't he? The break on Saturday.
Yeah, but also you could say that so would Bonin, you know, if you add up his four victories
in Roubaix.
And I don't think you wouldn't apply that. I mean, he's not as dominant as Pogacar at any rate, but you wouldn't say that it's monotonous. You would still say that it's just a legacy more than anything.
It is. I think, you know, there's a couple of things here. For me, anyway, it does feel a little bit like Groundhog Day. You know, there's Paris-Roubaix, even in those years when Tom Bonin was, you know, almost setting the modern trend, wasn't he? He and Cancellara with those sort of 50-kilometer breaks. You know, there was an element of suspense, jeopardy, uncertainty. I didn't really get any sense of jeopardy or uncertainty once Pogacar made his move. I mean, the longest break was in 2023 when he was over 81 kilometres from the finish was when he went. The year I went in 2022 was the first year. And I remember this kind of the sense of seeing something different in a race like Strade Bianche with all of the metres climbing, almost a 50-kilometre break. And that felt like a sort of threshold had been broken. And then the following year, it was just, you know, exploded again. And then there's almost something quite routine about it. 79 kilometres to go, he takes off, and there was not a great deal of opposition to that. It was two races going on at the same time. Pogacar for the win, and then the rest were kind of, you know, holding their, you know, they were kind of, you know, basically just holding what they had and riding in for the best result they could get. There was no sense that they were going to catch him, was there?
No, but they were absolutely on the limit.
Of course.
I mean, they couldn't go any further.
Yeah, of course. But this is where we've discussed this in the past, Daniel. There's two different things here. One is the athletic impressiveness of the performance, which is undeniable. It's incredible. It is incredible to watch. But sport relies on so much more than that, for me at least. You know, there has to be some sense of the surprise, the unexpected. I mean, a quick corrections corner, because in the build-up to the race last week in the episode, I said that in the three editions that Pogacar had won, he'd not suffered any misfortune. And of course, somehow the incredible incident from last year where he ran off the road into a field slipped my mind. Quite a few listeners pointed that out. And of course, I was like, oh yeah, of course he did. And I think even there wasn't the sense of jeopardy because Pidcock slowed down and waited for him to join back up. And
yeah, I mean, he could easily have broken the collarbone and been out for the classic.
Of course, right? But he didn't. That's what I'm saying. You know, yes, no. You know, he got lucky. So,
but one thing, Lionel, though, in all of that, it's. I mean, it's all of this is in the eye of the beholder. You know, his dominance is obviously beyond discussion. But one thing I do notice, and that's coming in play when you said that when you were there, it's certainly one of those things that when you look at the crowds and the, you know, how exuberantly happy and you know they were touched by Pogacar, really, and how, you know, when you see the crowds and how taken they are by his exploits, you know, and when you see the Santa Catarina, when you see him, you know, the reaction when he comes into the, you know, to Siena, and when you see Sexas coming into Siena, it's a moment where you really understand that people are experiencing grandeur. And I actually think that there's a very big difference of seeing it live, you know, in the flesh, and seeing it on TV and sort of getting a bit impatient with, you know, how come the rest of them are just that easily dropped. the fans are loving it. At least the ones.
Yeah, and we've seen that for years now, Brian. Yeah. We've seen that for years now. We've seen that, you know, when he's been at the Giro, when he's been at the Tour. I mean, the this was the second best, the second highest figures, viewing figures on Rai on Italian TV for an edition of Strade Bianche, surpassed only by 2020 when Wout van Aert won, which was a strange year because of COVID and so forth. I mean, I think we had this discussion many times already last year when obviously the Pogacar's domination, the monotony, as some people described it, Pogacar's domination was a big topic of conversation. We sort of promised that it wouldn't become a topic of conversation every week this year. And I certainly, Lionel, I'm certainly not going to play emotion police, emotion carabinieri, because I think everyone is entitled to feel the way they feel about domination. My personal feeling is that suspense in life, suspense is available everywhere. The suspense every morning when I get up and draw the curtains and see what the weather's going to be like. The reason I watch professional sport is because I want to see elite performance and something extraordinary. And Pogacar provides something more extraordinary than anything I've seen in any other era. And particularly in the match, this is not mundane domination. This is not sort of bean counting.
No, it's not. It's not,
you know, sort of routine domination, kind of just waiting for the sprint and then winning the sprint every time. I mean, people could say there were a couple of years there when sort of there was something very routine about the way Primoz Roglic was winning races. I took some sort of perverse fascination in that. But generally, seeing Pogacar ride with great panache, undeniably, he rides with great panache. I mean, I personally think that as a fan, this is the best thing you can watch. But it's a really interesting conversation. It's an interesting subject because it does really shine a light on how people react differently to different things in sport. I mean, the women's race on Saturday, a lot of people felt that the women's race was much, much more exciting than the men's race and enjoyed it much, much more. I actually thought the women's race, okay, there were seven riders coming up via Santa Caterina. And if you're going to talk about suspense there, okay, there was a sort of, you were waiting for a number of kilometers before they got to Santa Caterina, sort of imagining what this great showdown was going to be. The actual showdown itself was not all that. It was a bit sort of...
The showdown was positioning. The showdown was positioning coming into the last corner.
Yeah, was positioning. And actually, it was a bit of a letdown in the sense that you realized very quickly, very soon, that that's what was going to make the difference. It wasn't going to be this kind of shootout where everyone was kind of attacking each other. And so I don't know. I fully understand that. Well, I've sort of learned over the course of the last 2 years that people do want more suspense from Pogacar. I mean, I would sort of suggest that if you want suspense, all you need to do is move your viewing window 2 hours earlier in the afternoon. You need to tune in at 3 o'clock, not 5 o'clock, because at 3 o'clock, that's when you find out in the moment where he's going to attack. And the suspense there lasts about as long as it did sort of in the women's race on Saturday. You know, it's maybe 5 minutes, it's 10 minutes, and you're waiting to see when is he going to attack exactly and who is it that's going to follow him initially. Okay, then the suspense ends, and the next 2 hours, if you're not enjoying it, you can turn off your TV. But there is some suspense.
No, I think that's a bit reductive, Daniel. The point is bigger and a bit more philosophical.
You don't think that what you said was reductive, Lionel? I mean, I think what you said could be equally challenged in a reductive manner, no?
Well, fine. What I'm saying, look, Tadej Pogacar, I completely understand that, you know, the crowds are there to see him. He's like Muhammad Ali or Elvis Presley or Tiger Woods all rolled into one. To go to Siena and see him and be almost within touching distance of greatness, you know, someone who is absolutely dominating the sport. I'm not trying to do down that in any way whatsoever. What I'm saying is that a television sport, which is what it was on Saturday for the great majority of people, for me personally, I could have written down and put in an envelope what I thought was going to happen in the morning, and that is what happened. And for me personally, I don't like seeing the Premier League won by the same team every year. I don't like the kind of the sense of inevitability about sport. I like a little bit more. But that doesn't mean that I don't appreciate the brilliance. I don't appreciate the way that UAE Team Emirates, you know, they it wasn't a solo performance either. They laid the groundwork brilliantly in that middle phase of the race. And I certainly didn't switch on with an hour to go and see him away and think, oh, you know, I watched it from the moment it was broadcast through to the finish. And I enjoyed it on, you know, in enough of a level. What I'm saying is that I do feel like it's like watching your favourite film, you know, multiple times. We've seen a variation on the same thing 4 times in 5 years. And I think that the greatness of that is almost delayed for me anyway. I don't enjoy it as much in the moment as I feel it is significant for the sport. We'll look back on this era,
yeah,
like the Eddie Merckx 7 wins in 11 years at Milan San Remo, for example. Now,
I think one difference there is that the, and I keep, you know, when the discussion comes up in how could they be compared, and in a lot of ways they can't. And the reason why I think that the Pogacar's greatness and I think there's some subtleties that are a lot more than actual subtleties. The level of competitors, in my opinion, now is way higher than the people that Pogacar needs to beat are way stronger than the ones Merckx needed to deal with. And what, you know, that probably shoehorns us into talking about Sixth Ascenders to a certain degree, because he got closer than or maybe you could say that with some fairness that Pidcock got somewhat close as well. But I think that we saw a debutant, a 19-year-old debutant that got closer and that was stronger and strong enough to drop Del Toro. And I think staying on the broadcast, that was certainly worth anyone's time if they were interested in cycling to see what Sixth was able to do. No?
You're making out that I'm sort of saying it was a dull, flat spectacle, which is not what I'm saying at all. The thing is, the viewing figures peaked because people are tuning in to see this greatness. I completely get that. You know, the thing is, for me personally, I would probably enjoy next year if Tadej Pogacar skipped Strade Bianche and rode something else, and we could see him do something else. That's what the point I'm making. Paradoxically, the viewing figures would probably drop for Strade Bianche if he wasn't on the start line next year. I get it. You know, that is the nature of kind of fame, yeah, celebrity.
Maybe we should touch upon, sorry, that, you know, they changed the parcours. And it certainly wasn't for the better. And no. Pogacar was talking about that as well on the press conference. You know, they made it so that if they wanted action in a different way, and had the opposite effect. You know, there was less gravel at the end of the race, so he had to attack where he attacked in 22 and 24.
Yeah, I mean, this phenomenon of making courses harder, it's favouring Pogacar. We talked a lot last year about how UAE are doing this, and what we saw on Saturday was they pulled most of the race, and they'd pulled really hard for most of the race. I mean, I've got the statistics here for the average speeds in the first hours since 2021. The first hour, 2020, so the weekend was just over 51 kilometers an hour. And this is a trend. I mean, if you go back, you look at Grand Tour stages 2015, the average speed of the first hour, I mean, I won't give all the numbers today, but it's gone up enormously in the last 10 years, the average speed in first hours. But basically, they are almost riding a team time trial from kilometer zero now. And you say, well, how are UAE doing this? Well, between their sort of seven other men, they're only really having to ride 120 kilometers, or they did at the weekend, and he sort of did the rest. And what that does is that, well, the race is so hard up to the point where Pogacar attacks, that any sort of hope or any notion that a group will form, a useful group will form and chase him down, is completely, well, that's obliterated, because everyone is completely on the limit. I suppose one other sort of question mark narrative coming into this year was, is this going to be the year when he sort of tips over the edge of the plateau and he begins his decline? He's 27 now, isn't he, Pogacar? I think we've said before, statistically, that is the age at which, if you look across all professional cyclists, that is the best year in professional cyclists' career, when they score the most points, when they're at their strongest. Velon produced some data after the race on Saturday that suggested that his effort was more impressive. There were more watts. It was 380 watts average over 77 kilometers, as against 340 in 2024 and 2025. So the tone for the season is set. For those who are not enjoying necessarily seeing this in all of the big races. I mean, if you look at his race program, you've got a week off. You've got a weekend off now because we know that he's riding fortnightly throughout this spring. So the next race is Milan-San Remo. Next race after that is Flanders. Next race after that is... Oh, sorry, no, no there's Roubaix. Only 1 week between. So there's only 1 week between those two. And then he's going to do... It's a fortnight again, and then it's Liège as well. So, I mean, there are plenty of other races where you're not going to see Tadej Pogacar over the next few weeks. And he sort of SQ'd 1 week stage races. That's one sort of interesting aspect, I suppose. Of
I might not
of
even watch Romandy anyways, because I never do.
Yeah, well, he's doing, yeah. And then he sort of starts after Liège, he's kind of starting his stage race season. And he will be doing a couple of short stage races before the Tour de France.
Maybe I should just, we need to sort of stop repeating this narrative of whether it's exciting or not. I suppose the one comparison that comes to my mind is I'm thinking about, Muhammad Ali, who I mentioned earlier, the greatest fighter of all time, against Mike Tyson, who knocked people out in 30 seconds. There's a sort of Mike Tyson-esque element to Tadej Pogacar. It's kind of done and dusted much more so than anyone that I've seen in the time that I've been watching cycling on TV. It's just the sense that the race result is predetermined is greater. And for me personally, that's just, the interest in the side stories is, elevated perhaps as a result. And as you say, Brian, it was the battle behind that kind of maintained my interest in the last hour of the race. And and that's fine. I get it. You love just seeing the best of the best.
I find something unsatisfying about those eras in professional cycling. And don't worry, there will be another era coming very soon. An era in which you're not really sure who rules the roost, mm. and you get one guy winning 1 week, another guy the next week. I find those eras kind of unsatisfying, and certainly much less satisfying than an era in which we are seeing something that has never been done before. And I just marvel at it. And if you are to use the boxing analogy, if Mike Tyson, if he knocked someone out in 15 seconds, then I'd want to tune into the next fight to see whether he could knock someone out in 10 seconds and then the next fight in 5 seconds. And Pogacar has not ceased to amaze us yet. And that's kind of what I'm finding compelling about watching his career. And compelling, even, I was fascinated by Saturday, tuning in Saturday to see, he hasn't been to altitude. He hasn't raced before today. There are other riders. Sexas, has emerged. Other riders will be better than they were last year. Is that supremacy still intact? And we got part of an answer on Saturday. And that in itself was sort of justified me tuning in and kind of made me excited to watch it.
And this is not just to add sort of a bridge between these two perspectives. It certainly has not made looking forward to certainly San Remo, which I think was one of the best races last year, or Roubaix, because we know that the only one in those races who can really be, on par or better, he's ready. I mean, Van der Poel, what we saw in Omloop, he is as ready as he can be, and he will be a very worthy opponent. Especially in those.
But you see, that grips me because Pogacar hasn't won Milan-San Remo or Paris-Roubaix yet. And I think that there's more value in him winning one of those than winning another two or three Strade Bianche. And Daniel, I'll come back to you.
I think you would agree. I'll come
back to you in a couple of years' time, Daniel, and see what you make of Strade Bianche 2028 when Carlos Sastre beats Dennis Menchov and Christian van der Velde.
There you go. I mean, we've had those.
The Kolobnev year, the Strade Bianche that Kolobnev won.
Thomas Lovquist year of Strade Bianche. I was there.
Shall we move on? Because Paul Sexas, I mean, this was an extraordinary performance.
It was. So I've been listening to the Sexcast and Grand Plateau, the AIMC, the French podcast. And as you can imagine, they're going to have to record next week's episode in a hospital because several of the the co-hosts sounded as they risked suffering a heart attack or a stroke this week. We've touched on haven't we, in previous weeks, how he's sort of being described in the French media, Marc Madiot calling him the chosen one, Lelou. That certainly hasn't slowed down, chaps. Was this the definitive breakthrough? Actually, recently I had to write a chapter for a book about Pogacar's breakthrough. And the moment that I identified was, or the sort of the epiphany, was his first stage win at the Vuelta. And that was a day that's kind of gone down in history, has been, is best remembered maybe for Marc Soler throwing a tantrum and chucking his headphone out of his ear. But in this chapter I wrote, I sort of made the case that that day they were climbing up to Encamp in Andorra, and they went on a bit of a sort of gravel road section, but there was this incredible biblical storm. And there were no TV pictures for sort of 5 or 10 minutes. And I sort of made the case that this was the cosmos telling us that the world was never going to be the same again. No, that cycling was never going to be the same again. And, you know, they sort of, they emerged from this storm, and minutes after they emerged, well, Marc Soler lost his rag, but also Tadej Pogacar attacked. And that was his first stage win in Grand Tours. And two more would follow in that Vuelta. And that was the moment when we realized in his first season that this wasn't just going to be a good rider, a rider who would win Algarve or California. But he was potentially going to be a Grand Tour star. Success was Saturday that for him. I think there's more to come in the coming weeks, maybe at the Tour of the Basque Country in a few weeks' time, maybe at the Tour de France later in the summer. I mean, how earth-shattering was this performance by Saxas?
A few things to it. I mean, I think what we saw physically, you know, what he was able to do in Algarve, what he was able to do in the south of France, there's indications that Matteo Jorgensen is somewhat off the boil. You know, I don't think, you know, also what we saw at the time trial, you know, but the level of riders that he dropped in the south of France, that he was able to beat Ayuso in Algarve on that climb, how well he time trials, all of that is already proof that, you know, he is certainly way better this year than he was last year. He's winning races, he's defending himself. But I think coming into Strade Bianche as a debutant, you know, race knowledge in that type of parcours, you know, he's certainly a great bike handler and all of that. But to be able to do what he did, and I think the bulk of the work that he did after Santa Maria, which I think potentially, I mean, when I saw it, I think he's certainly jeopardizing his chances for the podium, because he was carrying Del Toro to second place to a large degree, how I saw it. Anyways, his physical strength is crazy in that sense. You know, I know he lost, you know, he wasn't able to hold Pogacar's wheel, but, you know, I don't think anyone is in for two-thirds of this decade anyways, but he's getting closer. And I know that losing a minute is still significant, but I think that the way he managed his ridiculous amount of powers shows, you know, initiative, it shows panache, it shows ambition, and he is not fazed. You know, a lot of other riders, once they get snapped after Pogacar drops them, their mindset is not to go and use whatever else they have in the tank to try and chase him down. He was not racing for anything else for a very large part of the last third of the race, which I think is fantastic to see.
Was it a mistake to try to follow Pogacar?
Well, and if he hadn't taken second place, I think what he saw, you know, he said that it was, he said he couldn't follow. That was one thing. But he also said that Del Toro somehow blocked him, that he couldn't really, you know, after that, the steeper section of Santa Maria, there's a long descent, and he couldn't, you know, he didn't have a good trajectory to follow Pogacar. But I think he wasn't there to race for second place. His mindset wasn't that. And when they come into that drag after, you know, that there's some hillier sections on tarmac after that, and he when the group behind him, and that was a very strong group, you know, the rational thinking would then be, there's 15 seconds to a really strong group that's chasing me, and everyone in there has, apart from Del Toro, has all the same thinking as me. They want to chase back Pogacar, but he was still pulling. He could have saved a lot of energy just sitting up, but I think his mindset is something else. And I think that there's a lot to salute there. You know, that he's racing to race to win, He's not similar to Pogacar in other ways, physically at least. You know, when you see him, he's lanky, he's big on the bike, he's not as aero as a lot of other riders, but his race, the head he has for racing is very similar to Pogacar. That's also what we saw in the South of France. He's not afraid of going solo, you know, he's not afraid of biting off things that a lot of other riders can't chew. So I think in that sense it was a breakthrough. I think what we're going to see with more hard racing under his belt, what you mentioned, Daniel, with the Tour de Basque Country, if he's able to come out even stronger than that, I mean, I'm not saying that I cannot fathom that he could beat Pogacar in the Ardennes, but I don't see anyone coming closer than either, you know. I think he will be a fixture in the podium in those races, in Flèche and in Liège. I think he'll be, I mean, what I'm saying is then also that I think he'll be better than Evenepoel, which then again is a huge step forward. You know, it's one thing being that close to Pogacar, but to be better than Evenepoel, who has won Liège several times, that is another real breakthrough.
Yeah, I mean, success, he had a very eventful last 75K, didn't he? I mean, there was a period where he was with Del Toro and obviously Success was doing all of the riding, trying to get back on terms with Pogacar or at least hold the gap, limit the losses. And then, I mean, if you take what I was saying earlier about how everything else happened behind in spite of Pogacar. You know, Pogacar was away and was going to win the race, I felt, from that moment. But there was a lot happening in that chase, the second and third group. I mean, do we even call it a chase? Because Pogacar's lead went up to sort of a minute, minute and a half at 1.2 minutes. And then there was all of that activity that brought it back together again and brought it back to, I mean, Success crossed the line a minute behind Pogacar. So there's an awful lot of concertinaing going on behind sort of Pogacar was almost a sort of constant at the front of the race. And Success was very, very lively there. He was accelerating hard to split that chase group again when it came back together. And then he had enough to take second place when, you know, as you say, Brian, you know, conventional wisdom was that he was really towing Del Toro up for a UAE Team Emirates 1-2, and that didn't happen.
There was some speculation, though, that I think, did you guys read that Del Toro was sort of like not that bothered about that, or he was halfway giving it away?
Yeah, it didn't appear, did it, on the live feed. And then some slow motion footage did appear of Success dropping Del Toro. And even that was, because that was from behind, and even that was a little bit inconclusive as to whether Del Toro had sort of nobly decided to concede second place, having not done any work. Of course, on the Sexcast, they rejected this notion. According to them, Sex has ripped his legs off.
For the amount of times he looked behind, if it was an agreement, it was certainly not one that Sex has trusted, because he was certainly looking not just in the rearview mirror, but he was turning his head around his shoulder more than once to make sure that he did drop him, and he did accelerate. Right? And knowing,
to be fair,
I don't think, why would Del Toro give that away at any rate? He had all the alibis.
Success did gesture to Del Toro to go through, which was very optimistic of him. And so it was, you know, there was a bit of, I think he had to make a move to drop him. I mean, Del Toro, he didn't just give up, did he? I mean, but then again, he was guaranteed third place, because by then the gap back to the rest was, I think, another minute. So,
I mean, maybe Del Toro considered that it was already a de facto 1-2-3, having heard the rumours that Paul Sexas is going to move to UAE imminently anyway.
What I would say about Sexas and Decathlon is that it was an incredible team performance as well, because he wasn't on his own, was he? I mean, Jordan Labrosse and Paul Lapera, both looking very strong, both there give him...
Labrosse, when you look at Labrosse's, you know, this year, it just proves a point that he's been able to make the rest of that team rise to the occasion. And it certainly looks that they've, I mean, it's not a team that's changed overnight, but they certainly are riding so much better now that they have someone to support who also delivers the goods. I mean, they've had a fantastic start to the season, not just with him, but also, you know, winning other races with Tobias Lund. But the way they're able to support him, it certainly shows that they, whatever else investments they've made, have paid off. Also, I mean, on the staff side.
Yeah, in terms of what we expected, I think we all expected UAE Team Emirates to be strong. I mean, they had Pogacar and Del Toro as two sort of five and four and a half star favourites. I mean, Jan Christen's been riding very well and did so again, although I'm not entirely certain he's the most trustworthy of teammates in the long term.
I was watching... I was watching that on Saturday thinking, oh, this is great. They've found, because we talked a couple of weeks ago about how they've lost Narvaez and they've lost Wellens for the Cipressa at San Remo. And we know that Pogacar has been training on the Cipressa, but there is this issue that he's got that they need to identify who's going to lead him out on the Cipressa. And Jan Christen, of course, did this incredible job. He effectively split the race, didn't he? On Monte Santa Maria. And I thought, oh yeah, Jan Christen, he could be the guy. He could be the guy who does the last pull. But I had visions of Jan Christen going away with Pogacar just out, and then Jan Christen attacking him.
it looked as if he definitely could go with him, didn't it?
Yeah.
See, that would definitely pique my interest. You know, Pogacar gesturing to his teammate to do a turn. Come on, mate, this is your job.
I mean, he looked stronger than Del Toro there, didn't he? It looked as if Del Toro was doing more the defensive role than anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And also a nod to Florian Vermeersch as well. He had a very good week last weekend. In that middle phase that we talked about in the preview last week, Daniel, to lay the groundwork. I mean, UAE Team Emirates, they had so much strength there, but they didn't put a foot wrong either. A couple of other things I wanted to mention. Roman Gregoire's fourth place I thought was very good as well. He is starting to look really good. He won the Fawn Drôme Classic last weekend. Had a really good year last year. Won the Tour of Britain, of course, the Lloyd's Tour of Britain. And his recent results, first at the Fawn Drôme Classic, second at the Trofeo Laguilia, we'll probably mention that again at the end of the episode, and then fourth at Strade Bianche. Really solid results there. And just a mention as well for Ben Healy of EF Education Easy Post, because I felt like Ben Healy, his move with about 42, 43 kilometres to go. He was with Andreas Kron, wasn't he, of Uno X Mobility, and they kind of rode across a gap, having lost contact with the first of the big chase groups. And they did that impressively. But it was a bit like Ben Healy doing what Ben Healy does, which is the sort of 40, 50 kilometre to go move. But in spite of what had already happened in the race, it felt a little bit like that was what he was going to do, regardless of the circumstances in the race, a little bit. Whereas we kind of all knew that the sort of 80K to go was when it was, well, when Pogacar made the move. A strong move, and there were a few EF Education Easy Post riders around him as well. I think Michael Valgren was one of them, wasn't he?
13th.
But it was kind of a, you know, that was in a sort of best of the rest category, really.
Yeah. Chaps, one last thing, just to, unfortunately, to go back to UAE and Paul Sexas. I flippantly mentioned these rumours about Paul Sexas being interesting, as you would expect, to UAE, possibly even, well, negotiating with them. His contract expires in 2027. As things currently stand, I don't know what you chaps think, but to my mind, bearing in mind what the boss at Decathlon, Dominique Serriez, has said, and even at the team presentation, I sort of winced when he did this at the team presentation just a few weeks ago. He said this team is being built to try to win the Tour de France in 2027 with Paul Sexas. Well, that's the last year in Paul Sexas' contract, but given what we know about the scope of that project, the budget, their ambitions, I think they might as well pack in if they let Sexas slip through
his
their
contract,
fingers.
In my opinion, his contract will be sorted out ASAP. They'll put an offer to him.
You would think,
if they haven't already.
But yeah, but it's a little bit worrying that these noises, and you mentioned his agent Una Lauka, I'm sure he's rubbing his hands. It's a little bit alarming that these rumours have filtered out about you. Maybe this is agent talk. Maybe this is an effort raise the up the ante on his salary.
I mean, his price point now towards Decathlon will be however much they're able to find on their bank account, and however much they can go back to Decathlon and the tour and the other sponsors to say, we need to put everything in this basket. How much are we able to scrounge up?
Yeah.
You know, there's no negotiation.
Yeah. And,
in that sense.
And in any case, I think 2027, or well, it would be for 2028, to move to UAE would be the wrong time to move to UAE, because Pogacar is still under contract until 2030, Del Toro until 2029, Jan Christen until 2030. And if Serres is talking about trying to win the Tour already in 2027, then 2028, 2029, you don't really want to be riding for UAE when Pogacar, I don't envisage Pogacar having started a precipitous decline already in 2028.
For sure, also Ineos, especially now if they have less of a budget restriction with other types of money coming in. Visma, who knows where they will end up budget-wise. I mean, there are only really three or four teams, including the one that he is riding for now, who will be in that game. Yeah. And I think that before the Tour this year, there will be, my guess is that he'll stay. That's certainly, that's my best guess. And they will announce his contract before the Tour this year. You can hold that against me if it's not the case, but I'll bet proper money on that.
Euan Lauke, the most powerful man in cycling at the moment.
Then,
he's looking to rekindle those memories of finishing 14th in the 1996 Giro d'Italia. Just to mention, I had to look that up, Brian. Well, I'm not that good.
Well,
just to mention, Daniel, the women's race, the podium was Elise Shabby, Cassia Nuvedoma, and Franziska Koch. And just to wrap up on Strade Bianche, there was a little moment that I saw on the TV footage at the end of the men's race, Wout van Aert coming in 10th place, just as Pogacar was kind of being spirited away to the podium, and you know, there was a kind of just celebrations around him. And it was one of yet another one of those kind of you know, sort of past and presence of cycling. I know van Aert's had a tricky winter with the crash in the cyclocross, but it just sort of really put what I was saying at the very start into context, really, because I can remember, you know, Wout van Aert being the big sensational breakthrough when he was third in the race for his old team. Or what were they called? Oh, goodness.
Willems,
that's it. Willems, Krellen Willems.
Oh, when he tipped over on the Santa Catarina.
Yeah. So, yeah, there we are. But I mean, hopefully, for my sake, Tadej Pogacar will say goodnight Siena after winning his fourth edition. I'm amazed we haven't used that one before as a title.
Today could be the day. And Lionel, just before we move on to part three, episode of Femina in which Strade Bianche will be discussed. That must be imminent.
It will be imminent, yes. I'll have to check in with Rose Manley about that, but it will be very soon.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also sponsored by NordVPN, the best and fastest virtual private network in the world. I've been a NordVPN customer for a number of years now. I first signed up because I was concerned about my internet security whenever I was online, but there are lots of other benefits too. You can save money on things like holidays and travel tickets, airline flights, that sort of thing, just by switching your location. And when you're traveling abroad, you can switch your location back to your home country and carry on watching your favorite sports events or streaming services without any geo restrictions getting in the way. It's the fastest VPN in the world as well, so there's no buffering or lagging while you're streaming. But the security aspect is the real key to NordVPN's success. It protects all of your data. It keeps your bank details, passwords, and online identity safe. It protects you from phishing attempts or viruses or malicious malware. And it's affordable too. Premium cybersecurity for about the cost of a cup of coffee each month. You can use one NordVPN account on up to 10 devices. And thanks to the Cycling Podcast, you can get a great deal too. At the moment, 4 months extra for free when you sign up for a 2-year plan at nordvpn.com/TCP. Try it risk-free today with a 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/TCP.
Well, chaps, we resume after another 15 minutes, 20 minutes off mic this time, discussing whether Tadej Pogacar dominating professional cycling is boring or not. and Lionel suggesting that I just go outside and look at the sky and watch planes.
Well, hang on.
Marvel at those.
At least give...
anyway.
Are you going to give the context for that comment?
No, you said, we're going to move straight on. Hang on.
You said that you can see suspense anywhere. You can find it in anything. And I'm just saying that, you know, marveling at just the jaw-dropping greatness, you could just go out in the garden and point up at the sky.
Well, that's what I'll do, well, Lionel. Then also, don't you worry, Lionel. That's what I'll be
marvel,
doing after.
You marvel at mediocrity. Is that better?
I'm a Watford Football Club supporter, so yeah, I revel in it. I revel in the mediocre. That's a criticism I'm perfectly happy to take, Brian.
Wonderful.
Suspenseful mediocrity. Anyway, chaps, Lionel, we've got other races to catch up on from last week, and there are a couple of big races that, of course, are happening currently, which we're going to get to in a minute. But what races happened last week that we haven't
absolutely
talked about yet?
Absolutely. I mean, Le Samin. I mean, this is the big one, isn't it? The big one of the week. I particularly enjoyed it, but it went to, it's kind of boils down to a sprint most years, doesn't it? Jordi Meus of Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe won that ahead of Lawrence Rex, who I want to call T-Rex, and Ugo Hofstetter. That was a podium there in Belgium. And then the Trofeo Leguelia, which is a lovely race. Great to watch. Unfortunately, we couldn't watch it this year because the race organisers didn't manage to secure any broadcasting slots for the race. It just wasn't televised anywhere. Which for a one,
I believe they changed it had changed the hands to another organizer, I think, and the TV deal was not part of it, which is sad.
And the UCI regulations are that a one pro level race should have broadcast rights in a number of territories, not least obviously in Italy. That would have required it being shown in Italy, but also available to other broadcasters. But yeah, we didn't see Santiago Buitrago's win for Bahrain Victorious. Roman Gregoire, I mentioned earlier, a very impressive week or so. He was second along with Antonio Tiberi. They were about 25 seconds back. But yeah, Ulissi, Vendrome, Scaroni, Morgado. So a sort of high level field there, and a good win for Bahrain Victorious. And then
just on the point,
the big, sorry, go on, Daniel.
No, just on the point of TV coverage, Lionel, this is something we touched on in so last week we released the Kilometer Zero. It was sort of the last part of the footnote to Trapdoor series about promotion relegation. I debated the UCI point system with Tom Southam of EF Education First, and we talked briefly about how the existence or not of TV coverage, or how long the TV coverage lasts, that can fundamentally change the way certain riders, particularly domestiques, approach races. If they don't have the empirical measure of UCI points, then they can look to show themselves, if they know the race is on TV early in the race, and that can be an incentive for them to actually do the work they're supposed to do. Otherwise, if it doesn't exist, then they might well think, well, sod that, sod what the direct sport team's asking for, I'm going to go for points today.
Anyone who wants to listen to that conversation between Daniel and Tom Southam of EF Education Easy Post, it's available for friends of the podcast. You can sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com. Really interesting, meandering kind of deep dive into the way the races are actually raced. And just on that point, Daniel, the Trofeo Leguelia, no TV coverage, but 250 points for Santiago Buitrago, the race winner. And the sort of crucial stat is that Simone Gualdi of Lotto Antimarché got 60 points for finishing eighth, and that's worth the same as a Paris-Nice or Tirreno-Adriatico stage win. And I mean, this is kind of nuts, isn't it? You win a World Tour stage, absurd, and you get the same number of points as finishing eighth in a race that's not even on TV. Anyway, that's cycling. It's great in lots of ways.
That's why
it?
You love it.
I
folks.
Love it. I love it. Yeah. Just give all the points to Pogacar and let's be done with it.
Well, Lionel, you mentioned Paris-Nice there. Should we start with Paris-Nice? Mm-hmm. We've had a couple of stages of Paris-Nice, a couple of sprint stages, sort of unusual sprint stages, and with both with climbs or with well, not so much a climb yesterday, was it? But certainly the first stage, there was a decent climb in the finale, and that got rid of a few of the sprinters, a few of the faster riders, and then it was very chaotic coming into the last couple of kilometres. Sprint was won by Luke Lamperti of EF Education First, of course, formerly of Soudal Quickstep. He took the yellow jersey, and then yesterday we had a stage that ordinarily would have been sort of set up for crosswinds, very exposed roads south of Paris, finishing in Montargis, and there was a late attack from Dan Hohler, another decathlon rider who's looking very impressive at the start of this season, and he was reeled in a couple of kilometres from the finish, or in fact less than 2 kilometres from the finish, and the sprint was won. A surprising winner, really. Max Kanter of Astana continuing their hot start to the 2026 season, but another very disorganised sprint, chaps. Very, very disorganised, a bit all over the place. Interestingly, earlier this week, I think it was, Arnaud Dely, Lotto rider, gave an interview in which he talked about how he prefers not to have a lead out. He has sort of analysed where he's won races in his career thus far. And I think he said he'd won 3 races out of many more than 3 races with a lead out. And the rest he just won sort of fending for himself. And yesterday or on the day before, they sort of brought to mind that interview a little bit. But on the other hand, Kanter had a brilliant lead out from Turnerson yesterday. He just didn't have a big train. But they have been chaotic. There have been some comments. Brian Jonas Vingegaard said after the first stage that he thought that it wasn't worthy of a World Tour race. A lot of road furniture in those sort of southern Parisian suburbs where they were, so difficult to avoid. But it did look a little bit gnarly to me as well.
As it often is, as you mentioned, in that part of France, or that southern part of Paris, as you were, even when they've done the time trial in that south southern part of Parisian suburbs, it did cause a bit of it divided the criticism, I would say. I was talking last night to Lars Bak, who's doing the commentating for the Danish broadcast, and another Danish rider, Søren Krak Andersen of Lidl Trek, the Danish champion, said he didn't find it particularly dangerous. One thing I think that is relevant to that context is that this is the first race that Vingegaard does since the Vuelta last year. So that's half a year of not racing, 6 months. So it could also, I think, have an effect on him that you go, you know, straight into that type of stressful racing on a World Tour stage, sprinter stage, where positioning and everyone is like he's certainly also at a good level because he's in Paris to win. But I think, you know, elbows out and all of that, it could also be a shocked start, not to his physical system, but to sort of for him to be in the peloton again. My opinion is that that's a relevant criticism. I just don't think it does him any favor to do it in the media because it sort of rubs a lot of people the wrong way. I think he might not care about that, but I think what it does is it sort of digs a hole or shows too much of a contrast between him and some other riders who might have done Strade Bianche, Umlaub and all that. And then there's all the other riders who don't think it was dangerous at all. You know, and if Vingegaard sort of has that reputation of not riding that much, he's certainly riding a lot more this year. You know, he's riding Catalunya after this and then the Giro and the Tour. I don't think it does him any favors to air that criticism in the public. He should go to Gouvenou, you know, the race, or, you know, the route planner, and talk to him about it, which he might have as well.
I mean, you're right. The road furniture is in some places extreme. A lot of roundabouts as well, which the roundabouts help, don't they? Even if they're roundabouts where they're going straight on, it kind of does slow everyone down a little bit and takes a bit of the edge off.
But those hasn't all of this been approved? Isn't that part of the protocol now that the race layout and the architecture, isn't that part of the structure now that it all has to be approved?
It does, yeah. I was talking to Dan Martin about this at the Tour de France last year. The difference is, you know, at Paris-Nice, they're not going to spend thousands and thousands of euros taking small roundabouts out or removing bits of curb and then putting them back, which is what they often do for the Tour de France. I mean, when you're in a town centre or city centre finish at the Tour, sometimes you can see where they've taken out, say, a speed hump and flattened it over, and then that speed hump gets put back in. And that's all part of the race costs, you know, borne by the local authority that is hosting the race. But, you know, it's a lot harder to do that for Paris-Nice. And I think we see, you know, some of these finishes, they're quite a long way on the outskirts of town, aren't they? They don't take the races into the centre of some of these small towns. And I think that's the way it's going, isn't it? And Brian, you made the point about Siena and the crowds sort of 10 deep in the, you know, in the Piazza del Campo there, you know, just a sort of sense of occasion and atmosphere. Of course, the geography helps there because the race has broken up a lot. They're not barreling into the square as a sort of 50 up sprint, which in the early days of a Paris-Nice, there tend to be sprint stages. So I sympathize with the organizers. They're trying to make an attractive race for TV. And I have to say, I mean, Daniel, I sent you a message about the Tirreno Adriatico time trial, which we'll talk about in a minute. But these races are both the same, really. And take this the right way, because as you both know, I love underwhelming mediocrity. But these are two World Tour stage races with a lot of history. But Tirreno Adriatico's time trial sort of made me think of sort of closed ice cream shops that haven't got ready for the summer yet, and cafe vendors.
That's exactly what I used to live just around the corner, and that's exactly what it is.
Yeah, you know, that you can imagine the sort of cafe vendors using the long pole to sort of poke rainwater off the cafe awning. I think of sort of an underwhelming lunch of sort of,
and that's actually where, oh, you'll have great lunches there. Make no mistake. But and the race finishes on the other side of the Adriatic coast, and it looks the exact same.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, but you could have great lunches, but whenever I'm in that sort of area, I end up in the place with the sort of white plastic furniture and the sort of pale, greasy batter.
You've had my phone number for what, 20 years now, Orlando? What the hell?
And then and then Paris-Nice is the same, but in French, you know, it's like these two races feel like going backwards. You know, we've had the kind of excitement of Omloop and Strade Bianche, where there's real sort of passion and fervor for various different reasons. And then Paris-Nice and Tirreno Adriatico, particularly at the beginning of the week, they feel like we're back in the sort of depths of winter, a bit of a slumber.
But Pogacar isn't racing though.
Maybe if he was at one of them, there would be a bit of stardust. But
Can I just say, and this might be too internal for our audiences, but I got a message while we were talking that there is a press buffet today in San Gimignano.
Oh,
the press buffets at Tirreno are legendary. I have been over the years. It's a good stage today. It's a good stage. We should say what's happened already in Tirreno Adriatico. That started a day later than Paris-Nice, and it was, well, you mentioned the time trial yesterday, Lionel, short time trial, 11.5 kilometers. Not a surprising winner. Filippo Ganna won. Some surprising results further down, I thought. Timon Arensman second, a long way down though, 22 seconds down. Max Walscheid third, which tells us that it was a course for the big men, the big engines. He was 26 seconds down, and Jonathan Milan was fifth, for example. Antonio Tiberi, I'm just picking out names or people who might contend for the GC. Tiberi was ninth. He looked pretty good yesterday, 33 seconds down. Roglic actually looked decent, I thought, 30 seconds down. And who else do we have? Jai Hindley is also at Tirreno. But the big stages start really today. There's a hilly stage. What should be, well, we said that the sort of visual identity of Tirreno Adriatico isn't always the most sort of fetching, considering it does often visit beautiful parts of Italy, but this time of year doesn't necessarily show them off to their best effect. But today should be a very photogenic or telegenic stage to through Tuscany to San Gimignano, the Manhattan of the Renaissance. With its famous towers. But chaps, I'm just thinking quickly about the sort of GC in these two races. And Tirreno doesn't have the big showpiece. Well, neither of them, in fact, really this year have the big sort of showpiece. Summit finish. There's a stage to Oran in Paris-Nice, but we had that stage last year, a similar stage. Michael Storer won it in the snow, and it's not a stage that's going to cause huge time gaps. So that will be interesting. There's a hillier stage on Thursday, which might turn out to be the sort of queen stage of Pyrenees. And similarly, Tirreno Adriatico is a kind of old school Tirreno with a lot of punchy finishes. We'll still get a quality ride, I'm sure, wins both of those two. But any thoughts on the GC, both of them? Ayuso's looking good in Pyrenees, I think. I think he'll be the main rival for Vingegaard. UAE have drafted in McNulty because Almeida... He pulled out through illness, wasn't it? It was illness. So he's another rider to look out for. But any thoughts, chaps?
I think Oscar Onley will probably have a good week, especially when they get towards the end.
Yep.
For Ineos Grenadiers. Lenny Martinez, a lot of focus on him as the sort of the sex ass that, well, I never really, I mean, he's sort of pint-sized sex ass, isn't he, really? Literally and metaphorically.
Do you know what, Lionel? Quickly, you were just talking about Sexas and possibly signing a new contract. It struck me in thinking about Ineos as well. I mean, Ineos have maybe got their future star in Onley. Maybe they think they've signed their future star in Onley. But it's a dangerous time. If you were a team who was wanting to invest in the next big Grand Tour star and you were sort of minded to invest $5 million a year or more on someone, I would suggest that it's a dangerous time window in which to do that, because we just don't know, you know, whether Sexas is going to be the dominant rider that Pogacar is. And, you know, Lenny Martinez is a good example of someone who Bahrain maybe took a punt on, and, you know, I think he'll do well for them and has already done well for them. But they presented him as a future, maybe a future tour winner. Well, he looks a long way from being that.
Yeah.
I think in Tirreno it'll be quite important for Del Toro to win, sort of for the internal relevance, the position for him at UAE. But I'm quite also curious to see how, you know, riders like Tiberi, as you mentioned, Roglic, and those riders will fare. It's a good parcours for Roglic, a lot of potential Roglification, and in the same way for him, you know, he'll only get that many chances on Red Bull this year, and then you know, he has some affinity certainly with Tirreno, and I agree with you, Dan. He came off to a good start yesterday. And looking at Matteo Jorgensen, I mentioned that he looks off the ball, but he's not riding the Cobble Classics this year. See, he's aiming for the Ardennes. So in typical Visma style, they tend to time it quite specifically when they peak. So there's still, you know, more than a month until he needs to be at his best. So there's probably a good reason for him being a little bit behind.
Yeah, Jorgensen's won Paris-Nice the last 2 years, and now he's here in Tirreno Adriatico, and automatically we kind of think, well, surely he's going to be one of the favourites. But for some reason, I don't know, Paris-Nice feels like a bit more predictable. The climbs tend to be a bit more sort of Tour de France light, whereas Tirreno Adriatico always feels a bit more tilted towards a sort of classics type rider rather than the sort of, you know, longer climbs. It's a kind of, I don't know, I could see Ben Healy doing a sort of 40 or 50 kilometer break on one of the days, for example. And it just feels, maybe this is just a kind of, just a sort of bias of having seen the way that Jorgensen won those two editions of Paris-Nice, you know, kind of fairly formulaic, straightforward, just steady, no real gnarly stages, whereas Tirreno Adriatico just feels a little bit more unpredictable. But
They shied away from a big mountain finish, you know,
and
I think they did well in that, looking at the weather in the coming week.
Just one other point, sorry, Daniel, on Luke Lamperty's win, his first win for EF Education, also the first win for them this season. EF Education first, God, that's going back in time, isn't it? Easy Post, isn't it? Sorry, Easy Post. But that leaves Picnic Post NL as the only World Tour team without a victory of any kind this season.
They are really struggling at this point. I think they're 31st on the UCI rankings when I checked last night. Anyway, chaps, cycling is no picnic. World Tour cycling is no picnic. We will be back next week with some form, I would suggest, of, well, Tirreno recap, Paris recap, but also San Remo preview. We'll be previewing the next dose of monotonous Tadej Pogacar dominance. No, it won't be that. It won't be that, because we know that Milan San Remo can't be that, and it will be very difficult for him to win that, but that is certainly his intention. Anyway, chaps, Brian, thank you very much for your company, and we'll be seeing you in the next few weeks. And thank you, Lionel.
Yeah, well, the one thing the Cycling Podcast can guarantee is a good dose of mediocrity. Don't you worry there about you that, Daniel. Just before we go, if you want to sign up as a friend of the podcast, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. I've got a small mini series, the benefit of my experience, 25 years of traveling over to watch the classics. Not really a travel show or sort of holiday show with specific tips of where to eat or where to stay, but a kind of a meandering look at, if you are thinking of going to one of the spring classics later this spring or next year or in the future, you might pick up some inspiration or tips from that little mini series, which will be kicking off with Milan-San Remo and the 1101 Cappuccino. You can sign up for that as well on thecyclingpodcast.com or on Substack. At last week's polarizing piece that I wrote about the kind of near miss that professional cycling had with the escalation of war in the Middle East, it struck me that had that escalated a week earlier, half of the World Tour peloton could have been stranded in Dubai, and we'd have been having a very different conversation in last week's episode. The reason we didn't touch on this last week was because, well, we don't do speculation, do we, Daniel? So we didn't dive into something that hadn't happened. But I do think that there are implications for all of sport, and particularly cycling, when it comes to the balance of power and sponsorship and money. And so I tried to address a few of those points in the 1101 Cappuccino in a piece that I titled Stick to Cycling. But if you want to read that, that is there, and there'll be another 1101 Cappuccino later this week. But that's it.
Excellent.
That's it.
That's it for now. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.